We tend to set ourselves goals of, oh, if only I could live in that kind of a village in, you know, in the south of England, like a quite near a station and nice little house, but not too expensive. And yeah, and then you get it. And so, yeah, you live in the suburbs. Hooray. Maybe that car, that new one there, that Tesla or whatever, I'll get a, then I'll be happy. You don't literally say, then I'll be happy, but there's a kind of sense of, that's all I really want. And each of these goals is met, and it isn't it. As the line of T.S. Eliot, that's not it. That's not it at all. And we go through life thinking, that's not it. That's not it at all. There is something in all of us, a need for connection and love and truth and a sense of something beautiful beyond. And we can, if you're religious, you call it heaven. And if you're a humanist, you call it a full and achieved life of friendship and, you know, elements of sacrifice and so on. But you know that there's a hope for it. But if you mislabel it and think that it's connected with money or cars or mortgages or jobs or status, you're never happy because of your status, because of things you've achieved. Happiness comes from somewhere else. And of course, I've yet to meet anyone who can tell you where it comes from regularly, where it can be tapped like some resource. Ah, that's where you get your happiness. We know there's fake happiness from a blow of a drug or something like that, and that couldn't be a more fake happiness. And there's the happiness of sitting around a table with friends, that's beautiful, fleeting moments with friends and family where it's all working and people aren't shouting at each other and you can just look at each other. I was at a memorial service for a very dear friend, the composer Leslie Bricus, you know, who wrote Feeling Good and Pure Imagination for Willy Wonka and Goldfinger and a lot of great songs. He was an amazing songwriter. And I remembered I had this diary entry when I was just getting to know him, where there was a party, I think it was his birthday, and it was full of people, some of whom super famous and extraordinary people. But I remember just catching sight of him and thinking he looked so like a Persian cat, just looking from one friend to another with this huge smile on his face, just being happy to have his friends around him. It's a simple thing, and yet it's the best thing. And we chase things that give us less time to see our friends. We chase work targets and we chase journeys and holidays and things with individuals and so on. And I think we grow away from it. I think the older you get, the less you appreciate friendship, which is really sad. When you're in your 20s, you tend to do things as a group. Mm. You go on holidays as a group because you haven't yet got married and partnered off and paired off. So I don't know if you agree with me, but I do think maybe that one of the jobs of getting older, well, I'm convinced it, one of the jobs of getting older is not to become gnarled, you know, like a tree. When a tree is young, you can bend it. It's, you know, a green stick, as they call it. You can bend it and shape it and so on. But once it gets old, you know, and it starts getting that bark, and if you tried to bend it, it would snap. And we become a bit like that.
Coming back to the first point you said there about the goals we should be striving for, I found that really interesting. If not striving for a gold medal or this thing or that thing, how does someone, you know, listening to this now, what kind of goals do you think would protect them against that gold medal depression? What kind of orientation?
It's an interesting point, and of course, I, you know, obviously understand that there are people who need to meet goals in order to pay debts, and, you know, that there are certain amounts of money they have to pay for their heating and their mortgage and all the rest of it. And I'm obviously not suggesting that that's valueless, because you need to keep a roof over your head and everything else. But in terms of one's own personal sense of fulfillment and self-worth and achievement, I'm more and more convinced that it comes from how you treat people and how they treat you back and how you would try to be a better person. I know it sounds really silly. I'm not a religious figure at all, but I'm very interested in religions. And I can understand that in some cases, religions help cement a sense of community. where I don't like it is where it's exclusive, of course, where you have to buy into a certain set of ideas and so-called truths in order to be part of that community. But I can understand how looking at a wider sense of life, and it's really about when you're falling asleep at night, and this may just be me, can I fall asleep at night and feel I've been a reasonably okay person that day? Is this someone I have to apologize to next morning? Was I short and sharp with someone? Was I a bit mean? Was I lazy? Did I lie and because I wanted my own way there? And it's not suggesting I'm a saint and I always manage it to, but I do have a very loud voice in my head. Philosophers call it a deontic or deontological voice, this sense of obligation that is a peculiarity, it seems, of our species. As far as we know, the image I always use because they look so cheerful, an Amazonian tree frog perched on a branch with its big grin isn't thinking, oh God, I was a terrible Amazonian tree frog yesterday. I really let myself down. I was mean. I was unkind. I must try to be a better Amazonian tree frog. What we admire about animals is they spend 100% of every day being themselves. And we as humans are fully aware that we don't. We are not fully ourselves. We lie, we hide behind, we pretend, we fail, and we judge ourselves. Now, that peculiarity of humanity people have tried to explain it in different ways. Obviously, the Genesis myth is that we ate a fruit. It gave us the knowledge of good and evil and the sense of shame of our physical selves, all those things that separate us from animals. Because humans, since we were cognitively conscious, have been aware that we're animals, because we can see that we defecate and eat and sleep and mate just like other animals, and sometimes very quite close to the other animals, depending on what part of the world we live. But we can also see that we have these other things that animals don't. Who gave them to us? Where did they come from? What do they mean? And how do we live up to them? Are they a curse or a blessing? Do they make us mini gods? Or do they make us the playthings of gods, a cruel kind of, you know, little as flies to wanton boys to the gods are we. They kill us for their sport, as Webster put it. And, you know, so, and those oldest questions still really obsess us, particularly now, of course, because in the age of AI, we are able to be gods ourselves. We are making sentient beings, and we will have to decide whether, like the Greek gods, we give them fire or deny them fire, and maybe they'll kill us. But will they have what we have, this sense of, I try to be good? I mean, you try to be good, don't you?
Try my best.
Yeah.
I fail.
Yeah, you fail. Yeah. It's right. And we all like that, but we don't pay much attention to that. And yet it's the most extraordinary thing about us. It really is.